Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, September 26, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Each week we analyze issues involving the news media. And by we, I mean Missouri School of Journalism faculty members Lee Wilkins, Charles Davis, and me. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. On our program this week, CNN responds to criticism over how it used a dead ambassador's diary. A new study shows the media affect what we remember from presidential debates, depending on whether we frame them around policy differences or the horse race. A journalist with personal experience calls on the American media to stop using the phrase illegal immigrants. Coverage of that blown call by the NFL replacement refs rivals the presidential campaign for hyperbole, and wait till you see how a Green Bay TV station played it for laughs. But we begin with a more sober story, the death of U.S. Ambassador to Libya Christopher Stevens at the hands of militants, and whether he predicted it in his own journal. Last week, CNN's Anderson Cooper reported that Ambassador Stevens was worried about security in Benghazi and believed he was on an al-Qaeda hit list. Cooper attributed the story to, quote, a source familiar with Mr. Stevens' thinking, but word leaked to other media that CNN had in fact retrieved the ambassador's diary. Cooper acknowledged that on Friday night, but said that CNN had corroborated Stevens' observations through independent sources and hadn't mentioned the diary itself because they were sympathizing with the feelings of Stevens' family. The next day, we got a sense of just how raw those feelings are when a State Department official who was on the phone with CNN and the ambassador's brother called the decision to use the diary without permission disgusting and indefensible. Well, Cooper tried to defend the network's actions anyway on Monday night.
Now, throughout all of this, we've tried to minimize the anguish the ambassador's family is obviously feeling, balanced against a journalistic duty to inform. Ambassador Stevens held a very prominent and public position, and as a news organization, it's our job to inform you of information that's important. This was not broadcasting gossip from the pages of someone's diary. This was not reporting salacious details of someone's private life. This was reporting information that could impact the national security of the United States and the safety of U.S. installations in other countries.
So let's dissect that defense. First, we're going to talk about whether or not CNN truly tried to minimize the anguish to the family. They did inform the brother that they'd found the diary at the scene of the murder. They did use an intermediary to try to return that journal, though they haven't been able to do that just yet. But there has also been some question, Lee, about whether they promised not to quote from the diary without the family's permission. Here's how that State Department spokesman put it. Whose first instinct is it to remove from a crime scene the diary of a man killed serving our country, read it, transcribe it, email it around your newsroom for others to read, and only when their curiosity is fully satisfied thinks to call the family or notify the authorities? Is that fair?
It's fair if that's what happened. The problem is I don't know what happened. So let me try to parse this a little bit, because I think there are two separable but obviously related issues. The first one was the one that Anderson Cooper spoke to, which is what is the newsworthiness of this diary? The second one is the one that the State Department official spoke to, which is do journalists ever appropriately remove what could be forensic information from a crime scene? That puts the First Amendment and the Sixth Amendment in a little bit of conflict, and that's when things can get wonderful. Having said all of that, if Anderson Cooper in the very first report had not fuzzed up the source, and I actually can't see a journalistic reason for fuzzing it up that way, some of this could have, not all of it, but some of this could have been, I think, appropriately mitigated. Just say where you got your information and take your lumps.
Well, let's take those one at a time. And Charles, let's start with the first point that Lee made and that Anderson Cooper made in his defense. We're a news organization. We have a duty and obligation to report on the contents of this diary. because this is a big news story, whether or not he, the ambassador, and whether the U.S. government knew about the possibility of instability, more militants, an al-Qaeda attack on the embassy. So did CNN, if they're weighing the family's feelings versus the news value of reporting this, they had to err on the side of reporting?
Oh, absolutely. I was really disappointed because I thought Lee and I were going to have a firefight. And then she comes out and I agree with her completely. The thing that they messed up was not saying, according to the journal we obtained lawfully by hanging out in the remains of the embassy that State Department personnel fled. These were journalists who were courageous enough to still be in there. That's how they came across the thing. They then pulled out that which was significant, newsworthy, full of public interest. As Anderson Cooper said, there was absolutely no salacious details revealed, despite the fact that there may have been some in the journal, although I doubt it. This guy was a diplomat. I don't think he was keeping, like, the Tatler journal. You know, it was probably very sort of business-oriented stuff. That having been said, I would answer the State Department spokesperson's rhetorical question, who would do that, with the answer, any reputable journalist would do that.
So why did they? I mean, obviously, we can't see inside the minds and hearts of the folks at CNN, but why wouldn't they just acknowledge up front that they had the diary?
I don't have a clue. I really don't, because it seems to me the most sort of basic journalistic tenet is you say what your sources are. Now, if we're to believe CNN, by this time they had already contacted the family, which means the family knew that they had the information. I also think that was appropriate. When you're gonna print or broadcast something that is gonna cause somebody anguish through no fault of their own, especially if it's about a family member who has been killed in this way, of course you let them know first. That's not an abrogation of any sort of journalistic truth telling or any other sort of principle. That doesn't mean that the family has a veto power over the content
right.
of your news story.
Right. I thought it was interesting that the State Department official tried to make the case that if CNN was able to corroborate all of this through other sources, well, then they had that information already. Why did they even need to refer to the diary at all? Could they
right.
have done the reporting without using the diary even as sort of source material?
Well, I think when you have it in the ambassador's own words, it's such good sourced material that's what I don't understand why they wouldn't source it. You would hammer it home. Say, according to the ambassador's own writing a couple of weeks beforehand, I would have driven that point home that I have the material. Mm. The thing that I find most disturbing about this whole incident is really not the State Department doing damage control. Surprise, surprise. Mm-hmm. What I find really disturbing is the journalistic community piling on CNN for what is straight up honorable, I think, incredibly ethical, with the exception of the transparency of the sourcing, journalism. And it's amazing to watch this sort of circular firing squad.
Although I did see, at least some mainstream media reporters and analysts actually come to CNN's defense, which I think was the right thing to do.
Well, and I think that the question that my husband asked me about this, which in this day and age you've got to ask, even though we don't like it, was, did any money change hands here or anything else change hands here that allowed CNN as an organization to get hold of this, as opposed to the other journalists who might or might not have been close to the scene? And that's just a question I don't know, but it's not an inconsequential question, especially when you have phone hacking and all sorts of other things that are kind of in this water.
Well, to put a finer point on that, had CNN acquired the diary in a different way? I mean, they appear to have just found it at the scene, but had there been some exchange of money or somebody had given it to them or whatever, would that have mattered? Had they quoted directly from it in ways that would have been embarrassing or hurtful to the family, would that have made a difference?
All of those things make a difference. They're what we in the ethics bills call morally relevant facts. So if you're going to quote things that are hurtful to the family for no public purpose, of course that's a wrong thing to do. If you're going to pay money for it, I would argue, no, that's not a way to acquire this information. If someone gives it to you, depending on the strings that are attached to that, it may be appropriate to take that kind of a gift. So, I mean, all of these have different nuanced answers, but I do agree with Charles. I think what was at work here was some level of professional jealousy, to tell you the truth.
Well, there was also, at least I thought, on the part of some folks, both within the media and outside the media, who were suggesting that the State Department's
I don't know, over the top, that they were lashing out at CNN to try to drown out a story that was running counter to their original narrative, which, you know, the Obama administration said early on that the cause of the attack on our site in Benghazi was this anti-Islamic video. It turns out now, and I think the Obama administration has actually come to the conclusion, that it was pre-planned by militants, terrorists, whatever word you want to use, with perhaps some affiliation with Al-Qaeda. So is the State Department still trying to drown out the criticism that they didn't get it right the first time?
Yes. And this is what public agency spokespeople tend to try to do. That's why I thought that CNN's response, which was, you know, put it in your pipe and smoke it, was the exact response that needed to be made. What I would have liked, and you're right, some people defended CNN. Glenn Greenwald, who's going to be on this campus tomorrow night, by the way, was very outspoken in defense of CNN. But a lot of the sort of mainstream establishment that you would think would be loath to criticize actual hard-nosed journalism jumped right on there.
Well, and I have to say, in support of actual hard-nosed journalism, I'm skeptical, not cynical right now, but I remain skeptical about any claims from our State Department that Al-Qaeda was involved. I lived through too much of, yes, they have the weapons of mass destruction, to be willing to say, just because my government, even though I greatly admire our current Secretary of State, says that it's so, that doesn't mean journalistically for me that it has to be so. My problem, of course, is I don't think we can go and interview Al-Qaeda, nor do I think they're keeping diaries that we will be able to find that are sort of going to give us this kind of more definitive information.
No, but I do think that journalists, if they do their job well, can get us closer to a definitive answer on that question at some point. Well, let's move on to our second topic. A week from tonight, President Obama and Mitt Romney square off in the first of three nationally televised debates. Well, a new academic study published in the Journal of Communication shows that what we remember from those debates may very well depend on how the news media frame them. Professor Ray Pingree and his assistants at Ohio State University asked groups of young voters to watch excerpts from either the 2004 or the 2008 presidential debates. And they were doing these studies right after the debate, so they're not showing them the videos now, looking back several years. Next, he had them read articles about those debates. One group saw stories that focused on the policy differences between the candidates. The others saw horse race coverage, stories where they were arguing about who supposedly won or lost, what the competition was like between the candidates. Then the subjects were asked to describe the debate as they would to a friend. Well, those who got the policy frame story tended to remember the issues dividing the candidates. Those that got the game frame tended not to. So, Lee, it seems kind of common sense, I suppose. Did they convince you, though, with the findings? And should we be worried about what the voters are going to retain from the debates starting next week, given the way that the pundits and the media seem to be focusing almost exclusively on tactics?
Well, let me answer what I think is the easier question first. Yes, we should be worried about what the voters are going to take away from things, because we've sort of plowed this ground, if you will, and I think done it in some ways that are not politically smart if what you want to do is provoke a civic and civil discussion about issues. So to me, that's the easy one. The first question you asked, Mike, is one of what I think is the big question in the theory part of the biz, which is we've been doing framing studies for more than 30 years. We have very few studies that answer the question, does framing matter? Or is this just a bunch of overeducated people who've read all of these stories more times than they should have, trying to come up with differences that are meaningful when, in fact, to the average person, they're not.
Right.
So we've got this study. We've got a study that that Fred Volti, who's one of our former doctoral students, did about terrorism. And so there's beginning to be a tiny, tiny stream of evidence that says that in some ways framing does matter. It influences sort of which schema you bring to bear on the news that you watch and read.
Well, I mean, Charles, obviously we should always ask questions about the methodology and any kind of experimental situation where you're, first of all, your sample is college students only, right? And then you bring in a little snippet of the video and show them, not the entire debate. Then you concoct a news story rather than bringing real news stories so that you can show the dividing line between sort of the policy frame versus the game frame. all of those things can make a difference. Nonetheless, I wonder if you find yourself somewhat convinced by this study, and if you worry about whether or not the media, as they've been covering this campaign, are likely to do us any service when the debates come around next week.
I certainly am worried, because I always see this swing toward more horse race journalism than ever before when it comes to debates, because debates create the natural frame. Who won, right? Yep. And so everything coalesces around that actually rather silly question without asking better questions like who said what about what. Let's take the policy ideas that were brought forth and contrast the two, because that's what a debate is really for. I think some people do watch it that way, but we also have, speaking of studies, we also have that study that we kicked around a couple of weeks ago that looked at 20 years worth of presidential elections and found that of all the things that influence the outcome electorally, the debates are the least important, despite the symbolic importance given to them. And that may have something to do with it, because they are so horse race framed that people tend to not remember them.
Well, and I think it's important to point out to our audience that the reason they have to concoct some of these stories, like the policy stories, is because journalists aren't writing them. And we're certainly not writing them at the intensity or at the level that we are continuing to perpetuate, oh, it's a horse race. And we're helped a lot in this instance by the campaign, where people say, oh, yeah, this is going to be the biggest impact on undecided voters. We're even quoting undecided voters as saying it's going to have a big impact on them. So I think we're kind of, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other here.
You have to wonder, by the way, whether this sort of constant fascination with process and gaffes doesn't contribute to the latest survey about attitudes of Americans toward the news media. Mm-hmm. This poll is from Gallup, released this past week, and it shows that Americans' distrust for the news media hit an all-time high. They asked how much we trust newspapers, TV, and radio when it comes to reporting the news fully, accurately, and fairly. 60% of Americans said they had not very much or no trust in the media. Also, according to the survey, they found that independents are sharply more negative than they were in 2008. And they also showed that we're paying less attention to political news this year in 2008. Can we say all of those things are related somehow?
Well, of course, because I think everything is related to everything else. But I mean, this year, I think it's tough to know where political news begins and ends, because news about the economy, okay, I'm a card-carrying PhD in poli-sci. News about the economy is to me, it's political. So political news isn't just about the election, isn't in just about what's happening in Congress. It is entirely about what's happening in our lives. And in that sense, in this year, almost everything to me is political and fodder in a different kind of way. As for the trustworthiness thing, I think if you drill down in those numbers, and I know we put it up on the blog, that the people who are the most distrustful are also the folks who watch Fox. And gosh, I do think there might be a cause and effect thing going on
there. Oh, but they also showed that independents, who probably don't watch Fox any more than any other media outlet, were the ones who had the sharpest change in their attitude about the media trust from one election season to the next. So whatever that means. Hey, Charles, the media came in for criticism on a different front this past week at the annual Online News Association conference in San Francisco. I was there for the opening address by former reporter turned immigration activist Jose Antonio Vargas. Some of you may recall that Vargas revealed last year in Time magazine that he himself was an undocumented immigrant from the Philippines. Well, Vargas called on news organizations to stop using the more common phrase illegal immigrants. He says the term is inaccurate, politically biased, and hurtful.
The term dehumanizes and marginalizes the people it seeks to describe. Think of it this way. In what other context do we call someone illegal? In what other context do we call somebody illegal? If someone is driving a car at 14, we say underage driver, not illegal driver. If someone is driving under the influence, we call them a drunk driver, not an illegal driver. And put another way, how would you feel if you or your family member or a friend were called illegal?
Vargas singled out the New York Times and the Associated Press because he feels that they could influence other media if they stopped using illegal immigrant. But the Times associate managing editor for Standard says the phrase is neutral and accurate. He went on to describe undocumented as a euphemism. The AP's response was to point out that illegal immigrant is still okay to use in some stories, though it is no longer the preferred term, whatever that means. So, Charles, who's right? I mean, are journalists taking sides if they use the words illegal immigrants, or are they taking sides if they go along with Vargas and don't?
That's a great question. I mean, the language is loaded with meaning and cultural relevance, and we wrestle with the evolution of terminology. It takes people like Mr. Vargas to sort of advance that conversation, and we may move in some direction off of illegal immigrant. I tend to agree with the New York Times standards editor right now, though, that it is about the best description of the individual that I can think of. Undocumented, as they said, is an amorphous term. It doesn't mean precisely what illegal immigrant means. Yes, I totally agree with Mr. Vargas that it tends to dehumanize, that it tends to stigmatize. There are a lot of perfectly accurate descriptions that do that, and some of them, over time, we evolve away from.
Yeah. Lee?
Well, I guess Charles and I are going to have just a bit of a fight here, too, because I think I agree much more with Mr. Vargas than I do with the standards editor at the New York Times. I also agree with Charles. I think this is something that evolves. But there are lots of labels that we use in standard English and conversation and certainly in journalism that if you put a little pressure on them, we sort of look at that and go, no, wait a minute, that's all wrong. So one of my favorite ones is working mothers. I am a working mother. I'm sitting here with two working fathers. I defy you to find the phrase working father in anything, let alone use the way that it is to describe women. Working mother is accurate, but it's, as to use Charles's word, it's loaded. And the fact that men who do work, who are parents, never get to be described as working fathers, that's an omission of a different sort. So I think we need a new word. Maybe people don't like undocumented, but, you know, illegal is like, okay, everything you do is illegal? No, you just don't have papers. You drive the speed limit, you pay your taxes, you do a whole bunch of other stuff. What's illegal about all of that?
I understand sort of, you know, the emotional weight behind the word, but I also can sympathize with media who are basically saying, you know, we're not the ones who started this really acrimonious debate about immigration. The country is debating this issue. We have to find some way to describe it. It is true that people who are in this country illegal are illegal immigrants, unless, of course, they're children who didn't immigrate into this country. They were born here. And the AP kind of makes that distinction. It just seems to me it's more important how we actually report the stories beyond the headline or the label than whether we use a particular word or
phrase. Did Mr. Vargas suggest an alternative term?
Well, he wants undocumented immigrants. That's the phrase he says would work.
I thought he might visitors or something. I mean, that you're right, Mike. We can't ignore the fact that the debate exists, and we are only trying to put a term to describe the subject of the debate, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I guess his contention is that illegal comes to a legal judgment as to their status. Well, right. The INS has already come to a legal status on their judgment. They are here illegally. That we can all, whether we agree on the policy, we can agree that they are here illegally.
Well, if you weren't keeping up with the latest political news or that debate yesterday, it might be that you were just too caught up in the other media-fueled scandal of the week. The replacement refs who blew a last-second call and robbed the Green Bay Packers of a win on Monday Night Football.
You see the one guy go up touchdown and the other go tied out like it's a pick.
How does MD Jennings not get credit for the interception? I have no idea.
This is deciding who wins the game on this call.
After further ado, the call on the field stands. Touchdown.
Seahawks win in the most bizarre finish you'll ever see.
And yet the replay clearly showed offensive pass interference, not to mention the fact that a Packer defender appeared to be the one who came down with the ball. Well, the NFL admitted the first mistake, but said it wasn't going to overturn the winning play. And so I guess, Charles, you certainly can't accuse Americans of taking their sports lightly. This has been the topic du jour yesterday.
Yes, we may not get too worked up about the economy or Iraq or Afghanistan, but by Jiminy, we can gin it up when it comes to an interference call in the Green Bay Packers game. I was watching it as it happened, and my phone literally vibrated nearly off the table with the tweets that were coming across. It was an amazing social media moment.
You know, Lee, I've watched several of these NFL games that have been played this season with these replacement referees, and it seems to me, on a slightly more serious note, it's pretty clear that the sports reporters, the play-by-play announcers, the analysts, they overwhelmingly appear to be favoring the union refs in their disputes with the NFL owners.
Well, and I suppose, okay, underneath the who won, this does come down to the money in professional sports. A story, I got an RSS feed this morning that, and I don't know if this is true, so I need to preface it that way, that said basically to settle this, each NFL team would have to pony up $100,000, which is truly pocket change for the owners as well as for most of the players. It's one of those things that you sort of want to go, okay, guys, if you're really incensed about it, why don't all the better played players get together and everybody throw in $100,000 and say, y'all come back because we can't do this without you.
So is it that obviously a simple solution, Charles? And is my perception accurate that the reporters, the analysts are all pretty much on the side of the refs as opposed to the owners?
No, I think you're right. I mean, it's about more than purely money, though. There are a couple of things that the NFL wants that are really tough issues, like when and how to demote referees who are having poor games, and also how to work in younger referees into the union stable.
Those and there's some retirement issues. Things at issue in there, too, I think.
But ultimately, overwhelmingly, and it's also interesting to watch the players sort of regain their right to free speech, because the NFL has been very tough on the expression of its player base. And on this one, I think they feel like they have such a dead duck on their hands PR-wise that they've got to let them go. And the tweets of the NFL players, I've followed about 20 of them this week just for entertainment, are unbelievable.
Well, here's a question for you. What do you do if you're the local affiliates, the media, the television stations, say in Green Bay, Wisconsin? Your team lost. Well, you can fan the flames of outrage, and certainly they've done that. You can call for an end to the lockout of the refs. They've done that. Or, as they did on NBC 26's morning show, you can decide that it's better to laugh than to cry.
This is your replacement weather guy forecast. It looks like it's going to be bad out there, people. 200 degrees below today, we're looking at, and it's really going to heat up. It's going to be like 346 degrees by noon. And
get out of here. Oh. What is going on? What do you got here, a thunder hurricane going on? A thunder blizzard hurricane. Way to go, Tom. Let's get to the good stuff here. Here's your real forecast. All right, 63 degrees by noon. 5 o'clock, 66 degrees. That's how it's done. Get it right, people.
And compare that to Rush Limbaugh's reaction, for example, who says that this controversy over the refs should show us to sympathize with conservatives who for decades have had to put up with the mainstream media constantly getting it wrong. Charles, you want to weigh in on either aspect of that before we wrap
just
it up?
Slapping my forehead. I think it was a great, humorous take. I also saw a wonderful piece on ESPN where they aggregated a bunch of smartphone videos that people took. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure which technology they used to aggregate that, but what a brilliant idea. There were people literally sitting in a sports bar in Green Bay as the play went down, and they found, I don't know, 6 or 8 different little anecdotes.
Lee, you have 10 seconds to react.
I was in the stadium when we got the benefit of 5 downs. These things do happen, and making fun of them is about the only thing that works.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week, Lee. Charles, thanks as always for sharing your insights and sports knowledge. Thanks as well to our technical team, Director Travis McMillan with RJI, and Engineer Pat Akers with KBIA. Thank you for listening and watching. You can find extended versions of the video clips we showed today, as well as links to articles about our topics, by going to our page under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. And if you want to ask a question, leave a comment, or share a suggestion, you can do that at views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. Join Charles, Lee, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.